Hi, it's another fine Sunday afternoon. Actually, it's been overcast and a little bit rainy, but it's still a good day. Actually, we need the rain, so it's good to have it. This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me today, Sebastian Matthews.
Hey, I'll take this day any day.
Indeed.
Yeah, late summer.
Yeah.
Winter.
Yeah, in December. Oh, well. Today, we have another special program. A couple weeks ago, I got to sit down with Nan Watkins, who's been translating the work of Ivan Gol, and we talked about Ivan and his work, read some of his poems, and especially some poems from his last pretty amazing book, Traumkraut, which she's doing the first English translation of. So
nice.
Let's hear what she had to say. Nan, read us a little bit of Gol's work.
This is a poem called 10,000 Dawns. 10,000 dawns, my angel, 10,000 dawns. 10,000 times the eye of the sun has come to open again our eyelids. 10,000 dawns for this one night of our love. Your head sculpted in my arms, the rose garden of your hair on fire with 10,000 red roses. Oh, what fireworks! And the 10,000 voices of waves. How many moons have passed, delirious or sad, covering us with the ecstasy of snow. And of old men who have lent us their eyes, and of children who have eaten our hearts in the 10,000 dreams of love. 10,000 dawns, my angel, 10,000 dawns. 10,000 eggs filled with birds and their songs. 10,000 sun yolks, more than make up for this death of 100,000 stars.
Fabulous stuff. It's almost impossible to talk about Ivan without talking about Claire as well. So I know 10,000 Dawns in particular, they authored together, essentially. It was a dialogue. I mean, they knew each other and lived together for 10,000 dawns. And yeah, and it's a fabulous book. This is available. It's translated by Nan Watkins and Thomas Raincrow, Ivan Gol's 10,000 Dawns. I guess it's still in print. So
yes, it is.
It's White...
White Pine Press White Pine up in
Press.
Buffalo.
Right, right. Wonderful little edition. How did you come to be involved with Gol's work?
Well, it was actually through Thomas, who had found a Thomas Crow,
right,
who had found a volume of Ivan's poems translated into English on the shelf of John Lane, who is a poet and writer in Spartanburg.
Right, right.
And he borrowed the book and brought it home, and we read it. And I was working in the library at Western Carolina at the time and ran to look up who this man was, because we really didn't understand the background. And without too much trouble, I discovered that he had written a very large volume of work, that he had married Claire, and the two had had a very dynamic and, you could even say, stormy relationship for many years. And the poem that we began with was one that he wrote on to honor the 30th anniversary of the day that they met. And they met on February 10th, 1917 in Switzerland. And so this poem was written on February 10th, 1947. 47, when they were living in New York City. And I've actually visited the place where they lived on the river, East River in Brooklyn, on Columbia Heights in Brooklyn. And he shoved that poem, 10,000 Dawns, honoring their 30 years together, under Claire's door on the morning of that anniversary, February 10th. So
nice.
It's a nice story.
Very sweet. Very sweet. Yeah. Well, I know Thomas... of course, has been interested in the surrealist for, you know, since he was in his 20s, at
least. Yes. Oh, indeed.
So I'm interested to hear that he didn't discover Gol. I mean, I didn't discover Gol either. The only Gol I knew up until 10,000 Dawns was Galway Kinnell's translation of Lackawanna Elegy.
That's right.
Which came out back in the 70s.
Yes.
And you know, I was floored by that. I mean, it's so clear that Gall is just a major poet.
Right, and that's a beautiful translation that Galway Kinnell did.
Yeah, lovely piece of work.
And Lackawanna Elegy shows Yvonne's honor and romance, I almost want to say, with the American Indian. He was fascinated with the people who lived here before the Europeans colonized the country. Mm-hmm. And that's not the only piece that he wrote honoring Indians. And where he lived, right on the cusp of the river there, I believe he was fascinated with the Manahatta Indians on Manhattan Island, and the Ifathonga, and so on. And he loved the music of the words of the names of these people. And he went up into Canada and also looked into that. So it was wonderful that Galway was able to translate that Lackawanna Elegy. And he did it with the encouragement of Claire after Yvonne had died. Yeah. Yvonne died in 1950.
Right.
So, and Galway Kinnell knew Claire Gall. And she
lived for quite a while after Yvonne had died.
That's right. He died in 1950 and she lived on till 1977.
Right.
So, and she spent a major portion of her energy in those years promoting Yvonne's work. Mm-hmm. And when she met Galway Kinnell and Robert Bly, she encouraged both of them to translate her husband's work, and they have done that. Mm-hmm. And Galway Kinnell did a full book, Lackawanna Elegy, whereas Robert Bly has done individual poems that appeared in selected poems.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, read us another one. Shall we talk about 10,000 Dawns?
Well, we could.
Yeah.
10,000 Dawns. Well, let's go back just a little bit and say something about how Gall got started. He was born in Alsace in 1891, and the years of his work, of his real writing, were from around 1920 to 1950. So he had 30 very productive years writing and translating.
Mm-hmm.
And just being very, very active with artistic circles wherever he lived.
Mm-hmm.
And
because he was born in Alsace, he was bilingual.
That's right.
He spoke both German and French fluently.
That's right.
Natively, one should say.
That's exactly right. Yeah. His parents spoke French in the home. And as soon as he went to school, at the time, Alsace was under German control.
Right.
So all of the schools were in German.
Uh-huh.
So all of the children were in this mixture of languages of French and German.
Mm-hmm.
And Yvonne's father died when he was very young, and he moved with his mother into Metz and went to all of the schooling there in German, and then went on to Strasbourg. And as he became older in 1914 and the war broke out, the First World War, he wanted to declare himself a pacifist. In fact, he did, and he left immediately for Switzerland so that he would not be drafted into the German Reich Army.
Right.
And that was a key point because Claire, also, who would become his wife later, was a pacifist, and she had been in Switzerland. And she read a poem that he wrote about the fallen of Europe, the fallen soldiers of Europe. And when she read the poem, she just was instinctively attracted to this man. And she writes a story about it, saying that she imagined he would be an older, bearded person because it had such wisdom about the sadness of war and the futility of war. And so she decided to look him up. And when she went to see him and somebody pointed him out in the room, here was this handsome young man.
Right.
And she was just stunned. And so she introduced herself, and it was, as they say, love at first sight.
Yeah.
And they were just inseparable from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And she herself had a career, or has really a full career too.
Mm-hmm.
And she had shown her first volume of poetry to Rilke.
Right.
And had gone up to Munich because he had said, I would like to meet you. Please come to meet. And there's another amusing story about that. She didn't stay terribly long because she got impatient with the fact that there was a whole line of women waiting to meet Rilke in Munich at the time. So she went
popular
back.
Guy.
Right, yeah. Right. So she went back to Switzerland and made a very clear commitment to Yvonne, even though she stayed friends with Rilke to the end of his life.
Yeah.
And there's a little book about that, their correspondence. Uh-huh. And that's never been translated either. There's all sorts of things.
Another project.
Right. You bet.
Well, do we have any of Yvonne's early work?
In terms of poetry? I might say that he also did many, many other things besides the poetry. He wrote... One of his early pieces was a play called Methusalem, and that is still in print in a New Directions collection of plays. It was a satire on the bourgeoisie, and he went up to Berlin in, I believe it was 1924, for the first performance of that. So in his, that was one of the very early pieces, and it... made him somewhat famous at the time because he had the nerve to speak out and really make a satirical statement on the bourgeois life after the war in Berlin. And I don't have that translation here with me now, but it's a standard that if people are looking into European drama, that is definitely one. And he influenced a lot of other theater dramatists through that play and others that he had written.
Does most of his early work survive in some form
or
other?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
It does.
Right.
He was a prolific letter writer. He worked together with Kurt Weill on two musical pieces.
Really?
One is called, the original title is called Royal Palace. It's not written, even though the text is in German. Uh-huh. Yvonne wrote the lyrics for it. It's a one-act opera. Hmm. And then he also wrote the lyrics, I guess we call it, for a cantata that Kurt Weill did. So he was a collaborator with all kinds of people all along the way, from the very early days like that, all through to the very end, and with artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chagall, Picasso.
Right. Because he founded, he had several publishing houses, publishing companies that when he was living in Paris and then later when he was living in New York. And he loved beautiful books. And whenever he published something, he enlisted the talents of his friends and Marc Chagall. For instance, Marc Chagall has made 8 drawings that appear in the 10,000 Dawns volume that Thomas and I translated. And they're wonderful, almost whimsical, and drawings of Yvonne and Claire. And the Chagalls were in exile in New York at the same time as Claire and Yvonne. And so they remained friends in Brooklyn as well. When I was searching for the rights to publish this book, I went to the museum in Brooklyn, and that's how I first got the permission to get the Chagall and the Gall together.
Yeah. Great. Little Django Reinhardt there. You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains. Now back to our interview with Nan Watkins. You know, we haven't talked yet much about Traumkraut, which is your current project.
Right.
And we should do that. We should talk about Traumkraut.
All right.
Because this is his last work. He came down with leukemia.
Yes, it was one of those things I think in a sense, you have to say, terribly bad timing in his life, because first he, you know, lives through the two world wars and the Depression, right, and in the summer of 1945, just when you might think that life was beginning to look bright for him, he was diagnosed with leukemia and told that it was a death sentence.
Was he still in New York?
He was still in New York. Mm-hmm. It was New York doctors that diagnosed that. And he managed to stay on another year and a half or so. And then the disease was making him very weak. And so he and Claire took a boat back to Paris, and he went almost immediately into the hospital in Strasbourg. Hmm. And that was where he had been a student years ago. So it was as if he was returning on some level to his native ground. And it was there in Strasbourg, in the hospital, that he began writing these poems of anguish about the death that he had to face. And I think all of the imagery that he had seen in the wars had to have influenced his idea of his own death. Mm-hmm. And Galway points out that death was a familiar to him from the beginning because of the time period when he was living and where. I mean, when and where he was living. So after he died, he died in 1950, and Claire put together the volume that he was working on. But very early on, he had a name for that. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, a made-up word in German. It's called Traumkraut. And if you speak German, it's an interesting word, because you say, what on earth can that mean? But the translation I'm using is dream weed.
Dream weed, as opposed to dream grass.
Yes.
Right.
Some people have said dream grass. But when you read the entire volume and look at it, he refers over and over again to a flower or a weed that has come to him. It is a very symbolic of his end and the darkness of his life. And I have wrestled with that title, but I'm going to stay with that for a while, unless I would end up with a publisher who would insist on something else. But when he was out of the hospital in Strasbourg, then he went back to Paris and decided that he was going to try to have a few of those poems that he was working on published. Mm-hmm. And the significant thing is that he had been writing poetry only in French for the last 20 years. Hmm. One possible reason for this may have been that he was on the blacklist in Germany because of being Jewish. And they had actually revoked his German citizenship in 1933, I think it was. Uh-huh.
Right after the Nazis came to power.
Yes, so that he was unable to publish his work in German. They wouldn't publish it.
Yeah.
So at that point, he was
trying... At the same time, they were driving Kandinsky out of Germany and shutting down the Bauhaus.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yes.
And so he was then translating some of the things that he had written originally in German into French just to get them published in Paris. Hmm. But when he was feeling this agony of his impending death, the only way he could conceive it was in German. Mm-hmm. So that's significant in the life of Ivan that he writes this. And he decides to write to an editor of a journal called Das Goldene Tor, which is the Golden Gate. And his name was Alfred Döblin. And he sends him five poems and says, I am writing these poems in German, and I feel, oddly, a new lease on life, because I'm able to write in German, and I'm returning belatedly. Of course, he's referring to leaving the exile, coming back to Europe. And he's wondering if this man sees anything in these poems. And he says, this strange Traumkraut, this dream weed, is illuminating my life in a way that it's never been shown to me before. And here are some poems. And Döblin looks at them and publishes all five of them immediately. So that was the beginning. He actually called it Das Traumkraut. The puts in the article there.
Right.
So he continues to write this and had his versions of the poem in a folder, a little blue folder that he had with him to the very end when he was dying in the American hospital in Paris. Mm-hmm. But somehow or other, after his death, that little blue volume, that little blue folder with his final versions was missing. And I'm not certain if it's been found right now, and I haven't been able to see that. But the only thing, reason that that's significant is because the book was actually published after he died.
Right.
And it was his wife, Claire, who edited the book. So you say to yourself, the final version had also gone through her, and the second half of the book was love poems to her. Because the one time when he seemed truly happy and had could see the beauty in life was when he was writing love poems.
Sure.
Otherwise, he was writing these terrible moments of his great pain and suffering when he was dying.
Right.
So the book has this combination of the great sadness, the agony of his life in the beginning, and then a series of love poems at the end where he's trying to reconcile the whole business of life and death.
Right, right. Well, could you read us a few of those?
Well, yes, I think
you could do that?
Yes, several of them are appearing in the latest issue of the of the Asheville Poetry Review. So I'm very excited about that.
Great.
And let me start with one called "This Holy Body" because it gives you a sense of his disease, his sense of wondering what is he doing in this body at this time. "This Holy Body" by Yvonne Gall. "This shaky house of bones built upon sand, lodging for my ancestors. From my eyes they follow all the roads I take. My spleen is their kitchen where they cook with fat and blood. In the niche of the ruins, my mother still sleeps. Old men's tobacco smoke clings to her larynx. My holy body. Sacrificial animals roar deep within me, and beef loins exhale their stench every Saturday. My mouth still houses century-old magic. In my ears, I hear a ringing and know God."
Zowie.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's a man who's struggling.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking.
Very aware of the precipice.
Right.
Yeah.
I will read a poem that is somewhat of a mystery and has fascinated quite a few people, not only other poets, but musicians. I've found that several musicians have actually set this to music, and it's like there's a mystery here, and everyone's fascinated by it. But it's the one poem in the whole book that uses the word dreamweed or traumkraut, so we'll use it. And the poem is called Alasam, and it's a word that, again, is a Gaul word.
Right. Right.
And but if you hear it in context, you'll have to make up your own idea of what it is. Alasam, the unshed tear in the hollow of my skull. From this there grew long, long generations later a dream weed, night yellow, murder sallow, unique flower, unnoticed by the bees. So the other in the fall, I was out in the garden with Thomas helping to pull up some weeds and things, and I came across nightshade, and I was pulling it up, and I was saying to myself, this is Gaul's traumkraut. I just said it. And then, of course, I look back, and it says night yellow, murder sallow. You can die if you, you know, drink, eat,
right.
The nightshade.
Nightshade,
and
right.
And I was just wondering if, this is just strictly me, I have no idea mm-hmm. if there's any foundation behind it, if nightshade could have been an inspiration for his Traum Kraut, uh-huh. for his dream weed. But this is the flower that he wrote to that editor back in Paris, saying, uh-huh. this has given me a new lease on my life, that I see this flower, that mm-hmm. it's with me, it's in my dream, mm-hmm. my dream flower.
Right, right, yeah.
And then there are other places where we get references to a dream weed type thing. This one we can call Bloodhound, and that's a piece that is very strong here.
Okay.
Bloodhound at my heart, who guards my fire, who feeds on bitter kidneys in the suburb of my misery, with the wet flame of your tongue, lick the salt of my sweat, sugar of my death. Bloodhound in my flesh, retrieve the dreams that fly away from me. Bark at the white ghosts, bring all my gazelles back to their fold, and bite the ankles of my runaway angel.
Bite the ankles of my runaway angel.
Right, right.
Nice.
In other words, his angel is no longer there to protect him, and he's just
gone.
Yes,
run away.
He's completely run away about the whole thing.
Yeah.
There is a story also about the writing of these poems that I don't want to forget to mention.
Uh-huh.
And Claire tells about it in her introduction to it. And that is that when Gall lay dying in his final days in the American hospital in Paris, the poets lined up in droves to donate blood for him. So he had such a series of friendships and people who just were so very sad to think that they would lose his great talent just when he was returning from mm-hmm. exile.
Right.
And he was not yet 60 years old, so it wasn't as if he was really an old man. And I have tried very hard to find out who some of these poets were, because she mentions they come from many countries, Norway and France and Switzerland and Germany, and she says a number of young Americans.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been trying to find out, but that's still a quest
still
that
a
I'm
mystery,
on.
Right.
I haven't figured it out.
Uh-huh.
But here's a beautiful one that he wrote in his very last days, and it's to Claire, and it's a classic, uh-huh. Yvonne Gall. It was written in the American hospital in Paris within the month before he died.
Wow.
Did I pluck you in the gardens of Ephesus, the curly hair of your carnations, the evening bouquet of your hands? Did I fish for you in the lakes of dream, an angler on your meadow shores? I threw you my heart for food. Did I find you in the dryness of the desert? You were my last tree. You were the last fruit of my soul. Now I am wrapped in your sleep, bedded deep in your repose, like the almond in its night brown shell.
Lovely. Yeah.
That's a beautiful piece.
Fascinating work. Well, Nan, thanks so much for coming in today and sharing your work with Yvonne Gall.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, we'll do some more.
Good.
And indeed, we will be doing some more with Nan coming up in January.
What a voice.
Yeah, she does have a great voice.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
And just beautiful work.
And that's Wordplay for this week. Wordplay is rebroadcast Tuesday evenings at 6, Wednesday mornings at 7, and is available, of course, 24/7. At WPVM.org.